When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Though Bryce runs through the city to escape Hunt in the aftermath of the Temple Acolyte's murder, Hunt trails her, torn between ensuring his own security and apologizing. Bryce hides in the White Raven and meets Juniper, but their brief gathering meets an untimely end. Hunt spirits Bryce away to Rune's house to patch her up, where Rune brings the news of the Karras group's involvement with the explosion. The result? A new roomie for Bryce by the name of Hunt Athalar. The views expressed by the hosts are entirely their own and in no way represent the thoughts or intentions of the original author.
This podcast is a discussion, shared to spark thought and conversation on the characters and themes of this novel.
The interpretations presented in this podcast are just a few of the many possibilities. Listeners are encouraged to read along and share their own analysis of the text.
Though the hosts speak mostly within the constraints of this book, series and extended universe spoilers may be discussed with or without warning.
Explicit language, as well as themes of sex, violence, abuse, depression, self-harm, and death will recur throughout this podcast. Listener discretion is advised.
This is part one of this week's episode. Stick around for part two, which releases on Thursday. Welcome to Book Talk for Book Talk, a podcast where we deep dive into the writing of your favorite novels.
This season, we're exploring Sarah J. Maas's first installment in the Crescent City series. This is Jack.
And I'm Amy. This week, we're discussing chapters 25 through 30 in House of Earth and Blood.
Question we're going to ask ourselves this week is, who's being honest and to what degree?
The theme we're going to see in this section is, appearances can be deceiving.
Mm-hmm. So we start chapter 25 with my favorite kind of hunt. And that is an apologetic hunt, a very guilty hunt. And by the end of the section, we're going to see that he's going to be able to fully apologize. But right now, he cannot. He recognizes how wrong he is. But there is something very clearly stopping him. And what is stopping him? Pride, ego. And, you know, I'm even going to throw in, can't quite apologize to this quote unquote feminine that he's struggling with. And I'm going to back this up with, and again, I know people are going to be like, he's not sexist. And I'm not saying that he's sexist, but I'm saying that there's sexist tendencies. Allow this quote to back me up. Quote, maybe he'd bribe her with a new pair of shoes or some purse or whatever the fuck might be enticing to keep her mouth shut. Like, you can't have that type of attitude and just be so like, I believe in equal rights. But he comes from an old timey world. He's a man of a different generation.
Well, and I think it goes back to what you were saying. He knows he's wrong. He is not prepared to admit he's wrong because he still has a negative view of Bryce.
And the negative view is so entwined with this very particular image of a woman.
Right. And the party girl.
Yeah.
He doesn't respect the party girl.
Yeah. And what sucks is that he won't apologize to her until that party girl image is gone.
Exactly.
And then it's like, wow, I was wrong. You actually aren't vapid. And it's like, even if she was, mm-hmm. she still deserves an apology, my man.
Exactly. She is still a sentient being deserving yes. that should be treated equally.
Yeah. And he talks about basic decency. And it's like, you got to find that because yeah. it's a missing.
That is right. Not only is it pride that stops Hunt from apologizing, I think in this moment, Hunt feels powerless mm-hmm. and Bryce holds power over him. At any moment, Bryce could call Micah and complain about him, get him in trouble. And in Hunt's mind, his bargain with Micah is at risk.
Yeah.
That's what's causing him to act as an alpha hole. He's trying to be defensive. He's trying to protect himself. He's uncomfortable with the idea that Bryce has anything over him because he's the umbra mortis. Mm-hmm. No one should have anything over him except Micah.
Yeah.
Bryce should not be the one to have power over him. This struggle with power masks what I think can be described as despair. I think Hunt is on the verge of spiraling because the reality of losing access to Micah's bargain is very real and is a visceral thing for him. He reacts almost physically to the thought of it. Quote, after completing those 2,000 plus kills he still had to make if he failed to solve this case, he didn't know whether the person he'd be at that point would deserve freedom. He's afraid of losing his identity mm-hmm. and to lose access to Micah's bargain basically spells, Hunt, you will become this shell that you can't respect.
Yeah.
He doesn't want to become that person.
You know what's interesting? And you and I both hate saying that word because we say it so often. But here he is struggling with this idea of like, I'm going to have to kill 2,000 people, right? Mm-hmm. But when it has to do with Shahar, he doesn't have that same kind of guilt. Mm-hmm. And we're about to talk a little bit about Shahar. And do we have any hard evidence that she was evil?
No, but I don't trust his view of her.
Not in the slightest.
One of my Crescent City 3 predictions is that we find out Shahar was actually a terrible person.
Just as evil as her sister.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. So let's get into some Shahar.
So Hunt thinks about Shahar in this moment while he's struggling with how guilty he feels about his treatment of Bryce. Quote, Hunt wished Shahar were here. She'd always let him talk, always listened and asked questions, challenged him in a way no one else had. In some ways, this sounds like what Hunt did for Bryce when they were in the library at the gallery and Bryce needed help with her memories. She allowed Hunt to ask her questions, talk things through, and help her work through the mental block that she had. He doesn't make that connection, though, that he was able to do that for Bryce.
Yeah.
Equivalent to what he wants based on his experience from Shahar. And so it's beautiful to me that by the end of this episode, we're going to see Bryce make that same offer to Hunt. Like, mm-hmm. hey, I'm here to talk no matter what. But right now, he's not able to see Bryce yeah. as that potential individual.
And I have nothing to base this on, but I'm convinced that Bryce does it in the, we'll say the quote unquote correct way, like the healthy way.
Yeah.
And I bet you Shahar was not that.
Oh, probably not.
No. So when it comes to Shahar, I have a lot of feelings about this sentiment. Like, first off, I love that he misses her, like mm-hmm. in her advice. You know what I mean? I was like, I love that he misses her. I don't love it, but I love that he misses advice from a woman.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important that this is a moment we're getting from him because it shows that he doesn't dismiss women's advice yeah. entirely, only if he thinks they're vapid.
Right.
And he can value it and he can be guided by that. Now, let me take a darker view on this because I can.
And so why not?
Right? Like, I'm here to hurt you guys.
And us.
And us. And because I hurt myself as I wrote this.
Okay, great.
So I think it also shows the power imbalance between Hunt and Shahar. And we already knew there was a power imbalance, right? Like, he was 28 when he made the drop and he found her pretty, and she found him really pretty quickly after that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this reminds me of another 19-year-old human and 200-something-year-old Fey male. But Shahar used his powers in a war. He killed over 2,000 beings And he does not have that same remorse. I mean, he has remorse, but it's not the same way as when Micah spells it out, right? Because it was like for a war. It was for Shahar. And she's the older one. There was a power imbalance. And I just feel really bad for him in like the narrative I've created in my mind, whether it's real or not. Again, he made that drop after his mom died. So who comes in an older woman? Like, mommy issues.
I was just thinking that. Like, Hunt has mommy issues. Shahar took advantage of his grief and vulnerability.
Yeah.
Hunt obviously loved and respected his mother, and he's mm-hmm. superimposed that on Shahar.
Yeah.
Is Shahar deserving of that? We don't know. And I don't think Hunt can be trustworthy when it comes to Shahar because of the circumstances around his mother and the rebellion.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that he was so young, so lost, mm-hmm. and then became a general, like went so high up mm-hmm. in command at such a young age. Even Bryce pointed it out, was like, that's so young.
Yeah.
It just screams some fishy, fishy things.
Right. I mean, what it is Shahar was using Hunt for his power,
yeah.
just like everybody else has.
Mm-hmm. We feel real guilty if we find out in CC3 that she was an angel, literally. And
literally and figuratively. Actually, I won't feel guilty. I'll badmouth her all I want because SJM has not given any evidence to the contrary.
Yeah, I don't like her. Hashtag.
Don't trust Shahar.
Yeah, I was trying to make a rhyme and I can't. Bar the Shahar. Go far.
No.
Drive away in a car.
Go to a bar. Drink. I don't know, whatever. I do want to point out that despite Hunt's back and forth, feeling guilt, feeling defensive, his actions can speak louder than his thoughts sometimes. And in this case, actually, I don't know. Is it self-preservation or is it guilt? He's never stepped foot into a club before.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes in after Bryce.
Mm-hmm.
He is still judging Bryce in this moment. He still is seeing her as the party girl because he's assuming she's drinking during the day at the club. And so to what extent is he coming in the club hoping for forgiveness or hoping that he can put her down so that he feels less guilty? I don't know the answer to that.
So I am going to make a case that Hunt actually is so envious of everything. He wishes he could be the party girl because everything represents freedom and it's something that he doesn't have. And I'm going to start with that case by mentioning the way he interacts with Juniper. So at first I was like, okay, this is similar to what we've seen with Syrinx and Lahaba, but it actually isn't. He doesn't compliment her the same way that he does with Syrinx and Lahaba. Now, he recognizes in his inner monologue that she is stunning and that she is gorgeous, right?
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't compliment her or flirt with her. He just appreciates her in his mind. So there's two things going on here mentally. One, he could say that he's too preoccupied with Bryce, right?
Mm-hmm.
And her potential downward spiral. He's got a lot on his mind. But I'm going to say that it's because later on, he's going to mention that like women don't appreciate him because mm-hmm. they'll see the tattoos.
Mm-hmm.
Women don't line up for him because he was bastard born. Like he views himself very much as an undesirable male. So it makes sense to me that he wouldn't do anything to be put down by Juniper. Rather, his compliments go to the other enslaved creatures.
That's fair. I see what you're saying. I think that Hunt's not flirting, because it's not flirting, but respect is being shown in a different way in this case. And that's with relation to the food. He asks her, are you okay if I eat something?
Yeah.
If I eat meat.
Yep.
And it's not flirting because obviously it's not, but I think he's intentionally not flirting with Juniper because A, like you said, he's focused on Bryce.
Mm-hmm.
And to flirt with Juniper is more of a threat to Bryce than to flirt with Lahaba or to treat Syrinx
mm-hmm.
like, you know, oh, good little beastie.
Yeah.
But to treat her with respect shows that Hunt is capable of respect towards women.
Yeah.
And I think that's new for Bryce as well. I don't mm-hmm. think that Bryce has seen that. I still think we're in the same vein as hunt with Syrinx and Lahaba. It just is a different tune.
Yeah, he totally sees them differently. And, like, he associates Juniper with some of his old war buddies.
Respect.
Respect.
In this same scene, again, food. Ugh, we love classic food is power moments.
Yep.
Hunt is there, theoretically, to apologize. So what does he do? He orders food for Bryce. Is it his way of apologizing? It could be, you know, hunter-gatherer. Or is it his way of asserting power?
Mm-hmm.
Let me read this quote. Hunt knows that Bryce, quote, hadn't eaten dinner yet, and he'd noted that she'd also forgone breakfast. And since she hadn't brought lunch with her or ordered in, he was willing to bet she hadn't eaten that either. He'd watched her go for lunch a few times now and had scented precisely what was inside her takeaway bags. So, A, Hunt is being observant.
Yeah.
That says a lot that he's remembers what her lunch orders have been while he's been watching her. Maybe because he was hungry and wanted some too. I don't know.
If someone like remembered my poke orders to the T.
That's a weight on my heart.
Done.
Yeah.
I will have all your babies.
So my question is Hunt sincerely sorry and trying to apologize by making sure Bryce eats something she likes? Or is he feigning that sincerity and just trying to get back in her good graces to cover his hide?
I think he's sincere. I think he's so sincere that he sincerely doesn't want to say it. At this point really can't bring himself to say it, especially right now, because he orders the food right before he realizes it's water, right?
Yes.
So in this moment, he really can't bring himself to say, what he wants to say is like, you drunk bitch, you're going to eat, you know, I'm sorry, but fuck you.
Yeah, yeah.
He can't say that. So what he can do is be like, okay, you haven't eaten and I'm paying attention to what you eat. So like, here's your favorite meal or something that you like.
Right, right.
And stuff. But yeah, it just shows how sincerely avoidant he is.
I mean, honestly, that is the best kind of apology is feed me my favorite food. And oh, you so paid true. For it? Great.
Yeah, absolutely. What I also love about this is that sex is being mixed with food.
Mm.
And, you know, you talk about food as power. If you haven't listened to our ACOTAR when we cover the ACOTAR series, we talk a lot about food as power. And I'm seeing a lot of sex with food right now.
Mm-hmm.
Quote, she hadn't eaten dinner, even though he'd been distracted this morning when she'd emerged from her bedroom in nothing but lacy hot pink bra and matching underwear. And food becomes a safe way for sex. It's a great use of being able to like assert power, but also sex. Like they're starting to interlace here where it's like, I'm thinking about you half naked. You should eat. Like, you know, like he really, and there's like, if he can offer her food, he can see her naked. Like there's going to be like, there's moments when they're like, there's a lot of food and sex happening and like food is power, but food is also a vehicle for sex.
Interesting.
Now, in my reality, that is true.
I imagine it would be true in mine, too.
Yes. I feel like in this section, in this episode in particular, there's going to be a lot of like wiggle room between establishing a sexual back and forth where they can feel comfortable with that. And I think that we're starting to see the little bits of it here.
That's an interesting thought. I wonder how that's going to develop. And I look forward to seeing that journey.
Just wait till we talk about the croissant.
Woohoo! I have to say, thank God Bryce calls out Hunt for ordering for her. Not for any reason other than the fact that I am forever scarred by our ACOTAR seasons when Feyre just sit there and let men serve her.
So annoying.
And pick her food for her and how much.
Yep.
And ugh. So Bryce calls out Hunt like, I know my body. I'll eat when I want to eat. Fuck you.
Yeah.
Hunt retaliates because he can't decide whether or not he should apologize, right? He's still defensive. He's trying to assert his power as a masculine figure. Who knows better? So he belittles her for her alcohol usage, even though just a page ago he realized, oh, you know what? She's reliving trauma today.
Yeah.
Quote, you have a rough day and you come to drown yourself in alcohol or vodka.
Yep.
Dude, You know she's been traumatized. You know you made her relive that trauma.
You did it.
And he can't accept his flaws.
And, like, you know, you have Bryce, who very clearly can call him out in every moment. Her silence in this instance speaks volumes. Like, mm-hmm. I really love that Bryce knows when to go off.
Yeah.
And when not to. Now, yeah. You can argue that sometimes she goes off too much and stays quiet too much. But in this scene, I think it's great where she goes off on him on, like, hey, don't control what I eat. And the assumption, she's like, yeah, you assumed.
Yeah. Yeah. When Hunt makes wrong assumptions, when anyone makes wrong assumptions.
Yep.
I think it puts Bryce in a powerful position.
Yep.
To ignore them and to walk away.
And she admits it, but that's what.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what she does.
I love this series of chapters because Hunt's world goes topsy-turvy. Everything goes upside down because of all the things he's learning about Bryce. All mm-hmm. his false assumptions are being revealed and the truth is coming in hot and spicy. When Hunt accuses Bryce of drowning herself with alcohol, he discovers, you know what? That's actually water. When Rune reveals that Bryce used to dance and would have gone into the ballet, Hunt realizes it stopped when Danica died. More reveals are going to come, but in this particular chapter, Hunt thinks, quote, not a party girl at all, just content to let the world believe the worst of her.
Yeah, you, bro, you're the world. You're part of it. Yeah. You're part of the problem.
It's curious to me that this is the moment. I don't know that this is the moment true respect comes in. I think it's what happens at the end of this chapter.
Yeah.
I do think this is extremely mind-boggling to Hunt.
You know, if you think about it, I don't feel bad for him, but you could almost say, like, you can almost say that you do feel bad for him because, like, he just fucked up so much. Like, mm-hmm. for how much he's realized how wrong he is in such a short amount of time is impressive.
And a big blow to the ego.
It's such a blow. There's so many truths that he's realizing that, like, in such a short amount of time.
Yep.
Now, about the dancing, when he discovers that Bryce no longer dances, he thinks, quote, he hadn't known. Not really. Those facts had been blips in her file. And that's the thing, though, right? Like, blips are what makes a person.
And there's more blips in her file that he totally missed and is re-revealed to him in this episode. It's like, Hunt, you weren't paying attention.
Yeah.
That's what it's showing me, is that Hunt had access to the information and chose to ignore it.
Yep. I mean, but also, for me, it shows that he doesn't, in addition to that, it also shows that he doesn't understand what makes up a life.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's not about these big, giant moments, which is all his life has been.
Right.
But Bryce is really, like, he'll see that when he goes back to her home later, all these moments on these picture frames. And that's the thing, like, life's about blips. It's mm-hmm. about dancing and the fact that she doesn't dance anymore. It's like these little tiny things about a person make up a whole story about a human. He's not there yet because his life hasn't been blips. It's been kaboosh.
Kaboosh. I think that's a great point. I think that Hunt has never had the privilege of a normal life.
Mm-hmm.
So he doesn't understand people who've had quote unquote normal lives.
He doesn't know how to stop and take a photo of the roses.
Yep.
Which is what he'll learn later.
Yep.
So to keep up with Amy's and my, because I'm bringing you in this with me, our messed up theory that SJM is setting up Rune, Hunt, and Bryce's love triangle. And I know this is all in Amy's and my mind, even though I feel like there's some solid evidence. You know, our minds have been scarred by a certain series that we both read when mm-hmm. we were younger. Mm-hmm. If you know, you know. Quote, well, if she's pissed at you, it'll make me look better. So Rune says that to Hunt, and it just sounds like such a thing that, like, two guys who are interested in someone would say.
Yes. Yes. I am going to argue a little bit later. It could be a love triangle with Bryce in the middle, but it could also be a love triangle with Hunt in the middle.
I mean, in the sense, it is a love triangle, just not romantic love.
Right, right.
And that's, like, what SJM, I think, is purposely doing, is that there is a triangle of two men who have dynamics with Bryce. She doesn't have to choose one. She can choose both, which she eventually does.
Right.
But there is, like, a certain amount of fighting for attention.
Yes.
And her approval and being on her side.
Yes. Yes.
And
even though one side of the triangle is familial love versus romantic love.
Yeah.
It's still playing out as two men who are romantically in love with her.
And that's what, look, that book, because I didn't read that whole series like you did, but I read that book. And I remember reading that book and being like, I'm okay with this. You may continue to be with one another.
No, I did. I was too.
Yeah. I was like, and I was like, all right, if this is what happened, I'll just support this, I guess. Literature has made me into a monster.
It's true. Things I would never accept in real life, I accept in literature.
Never in real life, ever. Well, some things, not that particular thing.
Yeah. AKA incest. Yep. We end chapter 25 from Hunt's point of view, and the explosion takes place at the White Raven. We move into chapter 26, and we're in Bryce's point of view right before the explosion. And I want to point out an interesting use of, I'm going to call it diction, which is the literary term, but basically word choice and the connotation of the words. Because to me, it's obviously intentional, but I can't decide if I like it or not. And I think it's smart, but I want to get your thoughts, Jack. Right before the explosion, Bryce is thinking how she feels like she's being smothered by Hunt and Rune. Quote, one minute she was just trying to not drown in the weight that had yanked her under that too familiar black surface. No amount of running could free her from it. Buy her a sip of air. A sip of air. When we sip things, it's liquids, it's beverages. Not something we normally associate with air. With air, we would normally think a lung full of air, a breath of air. Instead, she's sipping air like water, which makes sense in the context of drowning, but not.
Yeah.
And I wonder if it's just she's so mad, she's disoriented, she's confused. I can't figure it out. Why do you have any thoughts on this?
I can. No,
you don't have to. It's an interesting choice of words. And I bring it up because as a writer, this stuff is intentional.
Yeah. So when I was first reading it, what caught me was the word buy.
Hmm.
And I know that's like an actual phrase, right? Buying someone time.
Yeah.
But to buy someone time, you're kind of implying an exchange of some kind.
Yeah.
Like, hey, Amy, can you buy me some time? Therefore, you're going to do something. You're not physically buying it, right? But to buy her a sip of air. So, like, you know, you're looking at sip, I'm looking at buy. I think we combine these together and we create half the sentence. And but, like, I think there's something definitely intentional of it. I'm, you know, not that this is giant foreshadowing for anything in particular, but she's having a near-death moment and it kind of just feels like another, like, cheating death situation.
Yeah, I also like that you brought up the use of buy, because now that I'm thinking about it, it's like buying a sip of water.
Yeah.
Like, I'm in the desert, I'm looking for the oasis.
Yep.
Even though she's also drowning,
mm-hmm.
she's also struggling.
Yeah.
In need of whatever. So it's an interesting sentence. There's nothing else to analyze. No, I just wanted to point it out.
We just like to, you know, look at cool sentences.
Yeah, because we're writers. Yeah. We're going to.
Yeah.
Let's also talk about the fact that Bryce is probably among the weakest people or persons in the room. And when the explosion takes place, her first instinct is to turn around and jump over her friend who has made the drop. Bryce is probably the only mortal one there. And she's the only one that dives to save someone else that we know of. And for me, when I first read this, I don't remember worrying about Bryce.
Mm-hmm.
Because I felt not her mortality, but her morality was the greatest.
Yep.
Therefore, she would win. Like, she would turn out okay.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I was about to say, I'm like, well, she's the main character. She's not going to kill her off. And I'm like, well, she killed off Danica.
Yeah. Who knows what could happen? It could, if we killed Bryce at this point, it could become Juniper's story now.
And I think that's why, like, it was never, the stakes weren't meant to be like, oh my God, she almost died. The stakes are meant to be, oh my God, she doesn't care about her life.
Yeah.
And that's what's about to happen right now, where Juniper comes over and slaps Bryce across the face. where it's like, okay, like, I understand the sentiment. Mm-hmm. Like, you're so angry that your friend put themselves at risk, but, like, not cool. You don't slap them, yeah. Juniper. Like, that was, I was shocked by her. But we realized pretty quickly why, you know, she does it. To me, he didn't even have to explain SJM, but, you know, you did. I understood immediately. I was like,
I did too.
Yeah, I'm like, all right, you don't want to lose any more friends. Makes sense to me.
Well, and to me, that's why Juniper basically slugs Bryce. She doesn't want to lose any other friends either.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, it's all emotions are understandable. Juniper, don't hit.
I think what's also at stake right now is Hunt's perception of Bryce.
Yeah.
And I think this is a turning point for him.
Absolutely. So the turning point starts when Hunt carries Bryce to Rune's house. And on the way over, it says, quote, Quinlan didn't seem to notice he was carrying her. She was heavier than she looked. Her tan skin covered more muscle than he thought. I love, 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 love this. We are associating weight with muscle. It makes me want to scream for joy. Mm-hmm. Makes me want to go be proud of, like, weighing more and stuff. Like, one time when I was younger, I can't remember when, but, like, I went to one of those fairgrounds and it was like, we can guess your weight. And I was like, you're never going to guess my weight. Mm-hmm. And I went and they couldn't guess my weight. Yeah. Even as of, like, 2 years ago, I went to a pharmacy and there was a thing I needed to buy. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say what it was, but there's a weight restriction on there, which is, like, kind of upsetting because I'm like, what the hell? Like, that should be obvious. And I don't meet that weight restriction. Mm-hmm. And I went to the pharmacist and I was like, hey, like, I see that 165, which is such a low number.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm like, I see that's the number. Like, that's the weight. I think I, like,
this doesn't work for me.
This doesn't work. Well, I went up to him. I said, there's a weight limit on this.
Yeah.
He, not even kidding you, looks me up and down and says, you'll be fine.
Since a young age, no one's been able to look at me and guess my weight. They always guess significantly lower.
Always. And it's like, you know what this, like, section really made me do is, like, stop caring about the number. Mm-hmm. And I've been thinking about the number on the scale a lot more. And, like, I want to lose weight. I want to do this. And it's like, no, I want to, when I work out, I love muscles. Like, I love feeling like my legs can kick ass. I love feeling like I can pick things up. And him carrying her, to me, it shows that Hunt didn't complain.
Yeah.
He didn't say he was going to have to shift arms or anything. It was respect. It was said with respect that she weighed more.
Right. And he knows that muscles weigh more than fat.
Right.
And he's like, oh, wow.
So, you know, just find you a man that can actually carry.
I think he respects her more in this moment.
Yeah. Right.
I think it's because it challenges his view. I mean, obviously, Hunt has made so many assumptions about Bryce. But for her to weigh more than he expects challenges his view of her femininity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because we all do, right? We associate muscles with masculinity.
Yep.
With power. And Bryce has something Hunt did not expect her to have.
Yeah.
That associates her with masculine power.
Yep.
Another day is here and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Now, we get to Rune's house, and I have to say as an aside... Remember how we keep complaining about green carpet?
Yeah, everyone needs to stop decorating with green in this world.
The front door of Rune's place is also green, just like the Satyr's office door was green. I don't think this is a coincidence. I just don't. I just don't.
I think it's fair. There has to be a deeper meaning. Whether SJM ever reveals it, there must be a deeper meaning in her, like in her mind.
Yeah. Why keep going back to it?
There's other colors.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I agree. Remember how I said at the start of the episode that Hunt feels a little bit powerless right now? Bryce has power over him. Well, I think he continues to feel that because as he's carrying Bryce, he thinks about how he couldn't do anything he couldn't use his lightning fast enough to intercept a bomb or the bomb at the White Raven. And honestly, his lightning probably would have hurt somebody even if he tried to intercept a bomb if he knew it was there.
Yeah.
So he feels incapable of doing anything. And I think it goes back to my thought that Bryce is the only one who really acted in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
Even if she acted stupidly, even if she didn't actually protect Juniper, her intent was there and it was more obvious than anybody else's intent. And I think Hunt respects it because at least Bryce acted
mm-hmm.
in a way that was meaningful. It might have been self-sacrificing. It might have been because she doesn't care for her life. But even that, I think Hunt can connect with. And we're going to talk a lot about Hunt feeling connection to Bryce in this episode.
Yeah.
I just want to make another side note. Philip Briggs is in Adrestia prison. Adrestia means inescapable, and it's also the name of the main character of Jackson My Rock Opera that we decided we have to change because it's too hard to say.
Wait, was it really?
It really, really
was. It was Adrestia.
It was Adrestia.
Holy shit, I forgot about that. Oh, I really couldn't pronounce her name.
But now, I mean, the fact that it means inescapable, I'm sure that's why we chose it. You guys, we picked this name in 2018, so it's been a long time. But I'm like, oh, yeah, her fate was inescapable. So I was like, it's a good name for her.
Makes me want to go back to that rock opera. Anyone wants to watch a rock opera that Amy and I wrote, campaign for Muse to give permission.
For us to use their Absolution album.
Yes.
There are more ways that Hunt has misread Bryce besides the alcohol, besides the muscles, and I want to bring some of those up right now. Quote, the thick, angry scar cut across an otherwise sleek, unnervingly perfect thigh. Hunt stilled. She'd never gotten it healed. Earlier in this book, when Hunt meets Bryce after the time skip, he thinks about the scar she would have had on her thigh and assumes that she's gotten it taken care of and removed because she's a party girl and she's vain. Instead, he finds that that scar is there. It is proof of his actions and is going to become a symbol of his guilt because it upsets all of his assumptions about her.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's this moment where his guilt really comes out full force, as well as his desire for her. He resists that desire as much as possible. Quote, the heat of her soft skin still stained his palm. Which, again, is another interesting use of the word
mm-hmm.
that he is so into her but feels either so guilty or so undeserving that she now has become a stain upon him.
Yeah.
Or that attraction is a stain upon him. It's so fascinating to me.
It's fascinating because it's like normally I feel like in a lot of other books and stories we'd have moments where he stains her.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. I guarantee Azrael, once we get a little bit more of him, his whole thing is going to be like, I'm dirtying her. And it's just like, but right now, the heat of her soft skin stained his palm. So, one, I think that it's showing an intrusion of him.
Mm-hmm.
Her presence is now staining him. It's going into him. It is not him affecting her. She is affecting him.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
Thank you. And the language is so important with this because from here on out, language surrounding Bryce is changing.
Right.
Like,
absolutely.
This is the moment where, you know, everything about her is almost becoming a little bit more revered.
Mm-hmm.
We have that quote, unnervingly perfect thigh, silky skin beneath, brushing against the calluses on his palm. Bryce is now soft and unnervingly perfect. And it's so important that is obvious
mm-hmm.
because I do feel like, I don't want to call it heavy-handed because it's not, but it's like very clear that there's a change, right? Like now he's suddenly holding her. And I think that's really important because this is happening at the same time that we're learning about Hunt struggling with the idea of women wanting him.
Right. Right. I agree with you because in the past, it's just been, oh, she's got a spectacular ass.
Yeah.
Or, you know, look
with
at
a face
her
like and, that, she can get anything.
Right. Or a great range of lingerie or whatever. Yeah. And now it's about connection. Now it's about him touching her, the sensation of her, and him allowing himself to feel that, which is harder to combat when you're when you're distanced, right? When you're just observing, oh, a great ass or great underwear.
Yeah. Now that's unnervingly perfect ass. And Bryce is there to kind of bring him back to what they're both really good at, and that's humor. And humor for them is both a deflection and very grounding, which is, you're going to hear me say this throughout, but I really relate to that, where something each therapist I've ever, I've had always has to go, like, figure out is, are you deflecting or are you just being funny? And it's like, you'll never know unless you've been with me for years, and then maybe you will. But it's like, she is able to bring a grounding moment, and it's deflecting, but it's grounding, by saying, quote, when males are kneeling between my legs, Athalar, they're not usually grimacing. And that snaps them out of it. They're back. She made a joke. It's a sexual joke, you know, implying that he is now kneeling before her, but it's what they both know. It's what they're both good at.
Yeah. And this is where, for me, the feminist and Marxist lens converge, because sex has become powerful.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a way of Bryce getting the situation back under control.
Yep.
Moving on, when Rune comes back to the house, he interrupts this little tense moment of nearness and touching each other.
Are you touching my sister's thigh without me?
You're between her thighs?
That's without my place.
Rune tells Bryce that the Autumn King knows Rune's working with Bryce to search for the horn, for Luna's horn. And Rune tells Bryce in this moment, quote, he warned me of the poison you'd spew in my ear. Now, I know that this is a common turn of phrase, but it does make me think of Hamlet. Because in Hamlet, Hamlet's uncle kills his brother, the king, by pouring poison into his ear.
Yeah.
And that's where that turn of phrase comes from. So I don't know why it made me think of it, but I just thought.
It's a lot of ear mentions, because Hunt was just cleaning her ears.
Yes, because Bryce's ears were
bloody.
Bleeding.
Yeah. It just feels like there's a lot of, whenever there's a lot of ears happening in a short amount of time, I'm like, what you doing, Sarah? What are you trying to tell me?
I don't know. But I just, in case you didn't know that reference, wanted to share it with you.
I did not. So thank you.
You're welcome. We have another little power moment in which knowledge is power. Rune mentions that he wants to search the gallery's library to find information about Luna's horn or the Crystallos demon, because he's searched the Fae archives and he can't find anything new. Bryce and Hunt pretend it doesn't exist.
I love
because Bryce, or Rune, doesn't know for sure that it does.
Yeah, but the way that they describe it, where all of a sudden the two of them are like,
huh?
And then Hunt being, that's the first I heard of it.
It's a great comedic moment.
Yeah.
But it also shows that this love triangle is imbalanced, because Bryce and Hunt, despite their difficulties with one another, are a team.
They're so aligned.
They are very aligned, and they love to annoy the fuck out of Rune, which is even more hilarious to me. I had to point it out, because Hunt enjoys being above Rune in that sense. So when Bryce does admit to the library, Hunt gets all like, how dare you disrupt the balance of power?
But then she makes him feel better by being like, it's a cool kid's invite only.
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, I'm a cool. You know what it reminds me of is like how I tease Randall sometimes.
Yeah.
Like, it's my mission
to
make him and hit him and you and everyone. Okay.
Yeah. Everyone.
Yeah.
Basically, this entire book's sense of humor is Jack's sense of humor.
It's giving me notes. It's giving me ideas.
Yeah.
We get an insight to how deep Bryce's hatred for her father goes. And we're going to get a number of these moments in this episode. And I'm going to reference this quote. And this is Bryce talking about her father. Quote, to give him a scar like the one her mother bore along her cheekbone, small and slender, no longer than a fingernail, but a reminder of the blow he'd given her when his hideous rage drove him too far. I like to make my stance known. I am anti-Autumn King. I do not thirst for an Autumn Daddy. The only Autumn Daddy I recognize is Eris.
I had a thought that the Autumn King with Ember and then Bryce, how did I think of it? It could be like Lucien and Elaine if Lucien had never had a true change of heart.
Mm-hmm.
It could be any of the toxic dynamics, right? It could be Tamlin and Feyre. It could be Rhys and Feyre if Rhys hadn't worked on himself.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of instances of who this could be. And I think one day we're going to get a backstory that humanizes him in a way that we're going to feel uncomfortable.
I agree.
It doesn't mean that I want to forgive him. Like, that's not me saying that. It's just like, you know, creative predictions.
No, I completely agree. I think the Autumn King is going to have a backstory that we can sympathize with or empathize with.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe we don't agree with his choices, but we can understand the intent might have been good.
Yeah.
And he just
went too far.
Went too far, or, you know, ended up just choosing poorly.
Yeah.
And not knowing how to control the negative emotions that he has or reactions that he has. Because no one was there to teach him better.
I mean, and this is coming from a pre-book three release world.
Yes, yes, yes.
Just, you know, reminding people, the first time we'll record an episode after reading book three, we'll announce it. But, you know, I'm really hoping that book three gives him an opportunity to be like, my children are missing.
Yeah. We'll see. At the end of chapter 26, Rune receives a call from his father in which the Autumn King is like, if you don't get the horn or if it ends up in the wrong hands, you're going to be punished. And I feel like in this moment, Rune is channeling Bryce because he's not just like, okay. He's like,
fuck you, Dad.
I'll take a rain check, and just like hangs up on his dad.
Yeah.
He's not afraid of the consequences. And it feels very much like Bryce.
Yeah.
When that happens. And
spewing poison in his ears.
Right. He's not letting his father spew the poison in his ear.
Mm-hmm.
Great point. And I think it's because Rune is fighting for Bryce's attention that he's able to do this.
Yeah.
At some point in this, maybe the next chapter or the chapter after, Bryce thinks she's spoken to Rune more in the last few days than she has in the past 9 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I think because of that connection taking place, Rune is able to be like, you know what? It's not worth listening to my dad because I want Bryce to talk to me.
Yeah, I love it. So in chapter 27, Bryce and Hunt head back to her apartment and Hunt realizes that she's walking barefoot. I just have to recognize the internet thinks that Hunt has a foot fetish because he recognizes her feet a lot and admires them a lot. I don't think this is that moment. Because I think I'd recognize anyone walking barefoot.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I also think that walking barefoot, it shows a lot more. It shows humility. It shows loss. Like, Bryce is not here. She wants to, like, feel the grit on her feet, you know? She doesn't want to be like, you know, I don't want to get any more dirty. Help me. Hunt recognizes that she is barely holding on by a thread. She is holding on to herself. And he says, I'm not going to touch her or even offer to carry her. Otherwise she's going to go on a downward spiral. Quick question. Do you think he made the right call? Or do you think that's avoidance on his part?
That's an excellent question. I don't know. I think he doesn't want a repeat of the hamburger scene in The White Raven.
Yeah.
I don't think he knows where he stands with Bryce right now.
Yeah.
And he has gotten to a point of respect enough that he's going to trust what she said about the burger. Like, I know my body.
Mm-hmm.
I will communicate what I need.
Yeah.
And I think he's really taking that to heart right now.
I'm hoping that's what it was.
Yeah. Should he have offered? Maybe. But again, that puts her in a position of helplessness.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's what she wants to feel right now.
Yeah. You're making me agree. Yeah, no, good point. Like, because when I read this, I definitely was like, bro, just offer her to, you know, be like, hey, you can walk. I just want to offer. You can say no. But he does say, like, it's going to shatter her. And I believe it more now listening to you.
I love walking barefoot.
I do too. Yeah.
Growing up, in where I grew up, I walked barefoot outside all the time.
Yeah.
It's very grounding.
I grew up by the beach and same thing.
Yeah. So I think if she were walking through glass, if there was, you know, pieces of debris.
I mean, this
debris,
is, we're imagining New York sidewalk.
Yeah. So it's dirty.
Yeah. But like, you know, there could be debris.
But he doesn't observe it.
Yeah, that's true. I think if he did see like, hey, there's a bunch of glass shattered.
Right.
Yeah, that's fair. And so we start to have Hunt starting to see more of himself in Bryce. And we're going to have a lot of those moments in the upcoming chapters. But here's a little tidbit. Quote, he knew the reason why she no longer drank or danced or really seemed to live her life. The reason why she must keep that scar on her pretty sleek thigh. But he still can't see himself as an equal as her. Mm-hmm. Like, we're not there yet. But he's gonna continue to be like, oh, we're so similar. But I am so much worse.
At this point, we get to Bryce's apartment. Now, this is the first time that Hunt is being allowed into Bryce's apartment. And last week, I talked about how Bryce letting Hunt into the gallery library was kind of allowing Hunt into the inner sanctum. And that's when we started to see a little bit of a change in their treatment towards each other. I think that was just the first layer of the inner sanctum. The apartment is, I don't know if it's the true inner sanctum. I don't know if it's just the second layer. Like, mm-hmm. We still have a lot more book to explore, but this is the next layer of the inner sanctum. Quote, a white, deep, cushioned couch lay in the right third of the great room. A fogged glass dining table with white leather chairs took up the left third of the space, and the center third of it went to the kitchen, white cabinets, chrome appliances, and white marble counters, all of it impeccably clean, soft, and welcoming. Now, this sounds just like a lovely, beautiful, clean, minimalist apartment. However, I think that the use of white is intentional, and I think it's signaling a new beginning. Not only was it a new beginning for Bryce when she lost Danica and inherited this apartment, but it's a new beginning for Bryce and Hunt's relationship as they enter the apartment together. It's a clean slate even of Hunt's understanding of Bryce, symbolized in the furniture around them. Just have to point that out.
I love that. I wish Hunt paid attention to that.
Yeah.
Because I agree. It's like cleansing. It's so opposite than what Bryce was living before this with Danica and the wolves.
Yeah.
And rather than being, you know, welcomed and allowing that feeling and allowing this cleansing energy, Hunt is struggling. He's connecting to Bryce, but he also feels more distant to her than ever before. Quote, he took it in, standing like a piece of baggage by the kitchen island. I mean, like, it's so sad. Like, his baggage, his own, like, everything that he carries with him is there. And he's just like, not even a piece of furniture, he's an item that can be removed easily.
And forgotten and left behind.
And like later on, we have him saying like why he never decorates. Mm-hmm. It's because why when you're just going to move again?
Right, right.
Hunt asks what we all want to know at this point. Were Danica and Bryce lovers? And even though Hunt relates to Bryce, he's also missing that critical part, and that's friendship, particularly female friendship. And I say that because there is a loneliness epidemic with men. Maybe you shouldn't have built the patriarchy, just saying. That's a brought on by yourself.
Yeah.
But female friendship is, there's so many studies showing that relationship amongst women is stronger. We're more connected. There's that there's sense of community. And you have that, but also her adopted family. Like that pack, the pack of devils were her family. She spent every day with them. She lived with them. Like they're, you know, I think they only lived, she lived with Danica, but they were always visiting something, right? Like this was her pack.
Yeah.
And they all die.
Yeah.
And I think what's great, that's not great, but what I love is that Bryce kind of lays it out in a way that like makes a lot of sense. When Danica died, when they all died, a light went out in me. And I just like try to imagine our group of friends. Like I'm very close. We're a close group. I live with friends, you know, you obviously best friend. If all of you guys immediately were like massacred overnight and I had nothing left,
that would freaking suck.
Destroy me. Like, the fact that 2 years on and she's able to, like, do as much as she does is really impressive.
Yeah.
She viewed them as family. I think that Hunt relates, but he can't voice it entirely, you know? But, like, can Hunt actually relate? What do you think?
So, I talk about this in my next little section a little bit, that he thinks he can in terms of the sense of loss. Because even though he didn't have as big a group of friends as the Pack of Devils and Danica, he had Shahar. And Shahar was his only thing because his mother had died and was replaced by Shahar. So Shahar was his entire world. He didn't really have friends in the army. But even if he did, they all died pretty much too.
Yeah.
And so Hunt thinks, quote, Hunt opened his mouth to tell Quinlan he understood not just the complicated relationship thing, but the loss. To wake up one morning surrounded by friends and his lover, and then to end the day with all of them dead. He understood how it gnawed on bones and blood and the very soul of a person, how nothing could ever make it right. So I don't think Hunt understands what it means to be part of a pack, but he understands what it means to lose the only things that make you feel like you.
Yeah.
The only connections you have.
I don't want to take away his experience, but, you know, they were at war.
Yeah.
You don't know what's going to happen any given day.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's always that sense of danger.
Right.
You know, it's sad that everyone he loved died. Not a fan of that. But, like, you were in a space where that was a possibility.
Right. Where you knew it to be a possibility.
Yeah. Bryce was at the club.
Right.
It was just a normal night.
Right.
This came out of nowhere for her. She is not a warrior. She has not seen war.
Yeah, I agree. I do think it's different, but...
Well, I know you do, and we do, but this message is to Hunt, if he's listening.
Hunt's experience is limited, and what I appreciate here is that he's trying to connect.
Yeah, he's trying. He's trying.
He's connecting in the only way he knows how.
Yeah. You're doing great, Hunt. I'm proud of you.
You're so topsy. You're like constantly going back and forth with him this episode.
Yeah, I am. Look, my tummy hurts. It's actually doing better now.
That explains all of it. I think another way in which Hunt is relating to Bryce is that he's seeing Bryce give over all her power to her grief, that she's allowed her grief to snuff out the light within her. And Hunt relates to that in the sense that he's given over all of his power to Micah, to memories of Shahar, and therefore he too feels powerless in a way that he thinks is equivalent to Bryce's powerlessness. And because of that similarity, Hunt is willing to be vulnerable with Bryce. And this is where we're seeing that inner sanctum open up, where they're willing to communicate honesty and truth at a different level that is less superficial than maybe it was a few chapters ago.
Yeah.
Quote, Hunt clenched his jaw. She'd offered up a piece of herself so he could do the same. This is where he talks about the bargain with Micah. Quote, he waited for her judgment after revealing his bargain with Micah, her disgust with him and Micah. And Bryce doesn't do it, but Hunt expects it because that is what he did to her.
Yeah. It's so funny because it's like, why would she? It'd just be like, yeah, that sucks. You were put in an impossible position where you had to kill 2,000 people. That's not like a choice.
Yeah.
Here. Like, and who are her friends? Who are her only friends left? Syrinx and Lahaba.
Yeah.
She understands the concept of slavery here and needing to buy your freedom. If there's anyone who's going to have empathy, it's definitely going to be Bryce.
But I understand Hunt's point of view because him, he's like, everyone in my life has always used me. Does Bryce now feel like she's being used by me so that I can have my sentence shortened?
I agree. I'm back to being angry at Hunt.
No, but
like, not angry, but just more of like, it all makes sense. Like, there's I'm not disputing anything you're saying. Like, it makes total sense why he would do that.
And it makes total sense why Bryce would not.
Exactly. So what we're saying is, damn it, SJM,
you're so good.
You're making your characters behave in ways that make sense to who they are. That consistency is hard, man.
Consistency is really, really hard.
Yeah. The fact that we could sit here and discuss, well, of course this is how they would react. Of course this is how it is. You guys would not even under, I mean, you do understand, you're smart. But like, you know, it's so
as
obvious.
As a writer,
it is so hard to kind of like nail down that consistency, because you can have an image in your mind of how a scene would play out. But is that really how the characters would do it?
Right. Because as a writer, you're like, I'm trying to get from point A to point B. So I need you guys to say certain things so we can get to point B. But sometimes that's inconsistent with the characterization.
Absolutely. And this flows very well.
Very well.
Hunt finally apologizes, quote, I'm sorry I thought you were a suspect. And more than that, I'm sorry I judged you. I thought you were a party girl and I acted like an asshole. Okay, so like, I'm happy that he apologized, but he also got it wrong. He didn't judge her. He did judge her, and that was wrong. But the concept of being a party girl isn't wrong. And the apology is also an insult.
It's like a backhanded compliment. It's a backhanded apology.
To me, that's the equivalent of like, I'm sorry you're a yoga girl. Like, what? I'm sorry I accused you of being a yoga girl. I'm sorry I accused you of being obsessed with smut. It's like, sir, I am. What of it?
Yeah, yeah.
And Bryce calls him out. Like, she says, quote, there's nothing wrong with being a party girl. I don't get why the world thinks there is. It's easier for me when people assume the worst about what I am. It lets me see who they really are. And Bryce understands that there's nothing wrong with being a party girl.
Mm-hmm.
One, it's such a like sexist trope anyway, like the concept of a party girl, like what's the, you know, is Rune getting shit on? He's a party boy.
Right.
You know, but you don't have that terminology.
Yeah.
I saw this thing on TikTok where we should just start calling more things boy bands.
Mm.
Like Metallica.
Mm-hmm. I love it.
It's a boy band.
It is a boy band.
Like, what's wrong? It's a band of boys. Or football. Oh, you're watching your band of boys.
I love it.
Yeah. But, you know, it's just like these like little things. But it would also significantly devalue Bryce's time with Danica, because
mm-hmm.
it would taint it if she were to say, yeah, you're right, being a party girl is bad. Her and Danica were doing nothing wrong.
Right.
They weren't hurting anyone. They were still getting to work on time. They were just having fun.
Yep.
And she is able to use sexism to her strength.
And what's sexist about it for me is to be viewed in the one dimension.
Yeah.
Right. To be called a party girl is to only focus on one dimension of the personality mm-hmm. and the person.
Yeah.
Like you said, Rune's a party boy, but that's not the only dimension by which he is viewed.
Yeah.
Right?
He's starborn. He's the prince.
He's a prince. He's the Phaox leader.
Yep.
There are so many more dimensions to everybody, but only men are allowed to have multiple dimensions.
We are allowing ourselves to see them. I mean, it makes me think about like during the noughties, that's what they call like the early 2000s, and Lindsay Lohan, Paris Hilton, Britney Spears, mm-hmm. they were all partying and stuff. And, you know, like, I'm not here to condone drug use, you know, like to each their own, don't OD, don't hurt yourself. But like, they were partying. Let them be. What about all of the male celebrities that were at that time partying?
Right. That's still party.
That's still party. Let it go, Leonardo DiCaprio. Let it go. No one wants you around anymore. It's creepy. Thank you for listening to part one of this week's episode of Book Talk for Book Talk. We encourage you to rate and subscribe to our show on your preferred podcast listening platform. Tune in Thursday for part two, where we finish covering this week's chapters.
We would love to hear your thoughts based on today's conversation. You can submit your comments to our form at booktalkforbooktalk.com for a chance to have your feedback discussed during a future mini episode.
If you're enjoying the podcast, please visit our website, booktalkforbooktalk.com, to view our latest merch and learn about supporting the show through Patreon, Ko-Fi, or Venmo.
Bye!